Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Here it comes. Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes and with me is Peter Donahue and Ty Libby. How are you guys doing?
Good afternoon.
Hey, Andy.
Hey, Ty.
How you doing?
I'm just waiting for your weather report.
Ice storm?
We found out through these past few weeks that apparently it can get cold enough to not be able to play golf indoors, where we've had to cancel our classes. Didn't think that was possible. But
negative 20 is not fun.
Yeah. So, but we're back. You know, we're rolling. Get back into the podcast swing, hopefully. We have another chapter of Zen Golf on the docket for today. This chapter is about basic goodness and how that could possibly relate to golf. We're going to see if we can find a way through the, I don't know, the foliage or the dense brush into a beautiful
fairway of life.
Of life, exactly. Thank you. I needed help with that one. Okay, Pete, you're our designated reader, so why don't you start with this story. Again, this is Zen Golf. It's a book by Dr. Joseph Parent, and we kind of just read stuff and find what we like. So take it away.
A young man had a clay statue, a family heirloom. He always wished that it were bright, shiny gold instead of plain brown clay. When he began to earn a living, he set aside a little now and then until he had enough for his special project, and that was to have his statue covered with gold. Now it looked just the way he had wanted it to, and people admired it. He felt very proud that he had a gold statue. However, the gold plating didn't stick to the clay very well, and it wasn't long before it began to flake off in spots. So he had it gold plated again. Soon he found himself using all of his time and his resources to maintain the gold facade of his statue. One day his grandfather returned from a journey of many years. The young man wanted to show him how he had made the clay statue into a gold one. However, the clay was showing through in many spots, so he was somewhat embarrassed. The old man smiled and held the statue lovingly. With a moist cloth, he gently rubbed it and gradually dissolved some of the clay. He said, "Many years ago, the statue must have fallen in the mud and become covered with it. As a very young child, you wouldn't have known the difference. You forgot and thought it was just a clay statue. But look here." He showed his grandson the place where the clay was removed, and a bright yellow color shone through. He said, "Underneath the covering of clay, your statue has been solid gold from the very beginning. You never needed to put more gold on to cover the clay. Now that you know what its nature really is, all you have to do is gently remove the clay, and you'll reveal the gold statue you've possessed all along." One of the most fundamental principles of Buddhist and Shambhala traditions, as taught by my teacher Shogam Trungpa, is that the true nature of human beings is basic goodness. As he said, this is not a matter of talking yourself into believing that everything is okay. You are genuine and good just as you are. It is the simple, direct appreciation of being alive that is common to everyone. Golfers recognize it that moment after seemingly effortless swing sends a ball soaring into the sky.
Thank you. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I think that let's go down the next paragraph.
Okay, one more.
This is a perspective of richness, wholeness, that nothing in our fundamental being is flawed or missing. Acknowledging our own basic goodness means taking the attitude that there is something fundamentally, essentially right with us. how we feel about ourselves as a person doesn't need to depend on the quality of a particular golf shot or the outcome of a round. I guess that's what we needed to know.
There we go. Yeah. Connected it back a little bit.
Yes.
I like in the paragraph, you know, last sentence, he says, golfers recognize it. He recognizes basic goodness, or that you're inherently good, in the moment after a seemingly effortless golf swing sends a golf ball soaring into the sky. Have you guys ever felt that, or do you feel... I love the way he, you know, that aware that... the way he puts words to, like, the feeling of a well-struck golf shot, and the way he says, like, it's a feeling of goodness, and that almost all is right with the world.
I've absolutely felt that, and highlighted that sentence when I was reading this paragraph. But, yeah, just the letting go and making a nice, smooth, solid swing, not worrying about the outcome, and having the feel of the ball flying off the club, it's one of the best feelings in golf for me. It doesn't happen often, but... it's great when it happens.
Yeah. What about you, Pete?
Well, I think, you know, I have felt that. I mean, I've felt the wonderfulness and that everything is right with the world. But I guess I've always thought that what I was in golf was a creation, that it was actually deliberate, that it wasn't something that I... you know, just walked out of my mother's womb and had a goodness in me that knew how to swing a golf club. You know, I know I didn't know how to swing a golf club because I didn't even understand what a golf club was when I first looked at it. So I look at it as a learned thing. And so rather than being something that's in my very nature, I look at it as being something that I've created in my own being.
That's a really interesting point. I'm trying to think, how do those two things relate or overlap, or how do they work together? Because I feel like I'm still putting this thought together, but just because something is created doesn't mean that it wasn't almost like always there. Maybe I'm contradicting myself by saying that, but maybe you're, by creating that, you're almost uncovering something, or you're waking up to something that kind of was there. And I don't know, the reason I like that so much, or kind of like the words that he puts to it, is you ask people I ask people so often, like, why they play golf, and no one really has a good reason for it. They say the score. I like to be outside. I like a competition. It's like, well, there's so many other, you can just go for a walk outside if that's why you know, if that's all you want to do. But we do this for some other reason. And I think this is like one of those reasons, and just no one really realizes it yet. That feeling of a well-struck shot, there's almost nothing like it in any other sport or activity that at least I've played.
Yeah. No, I think being able to create what you want, to create your vision, and I think it's you know, I mean, when I'm driving in my car, you know, especially driving through really interesting country, when I go up to Green Bay, for instance, with Maryland, we pass this country where, you know, it's just a field, it's a farm field where cattle graze, but if you went from one ridge across this flat plain to this other ridge where these oak trees are growing, you know, I just, every time I drive by it, I say, boy, I wish I had a golf club and a ball. I'd like to connect with that thing over there. I'd like to fly over this field and be able to, you know, go to the other side. Now, some guys, you know, just the joy. I remember when up in Willow Hill, you used to love to just hit down towards the railroad bridge.
Yeah, you down know, the big
to,
hill.
Yeah, just yeah. to launch one off the end of the mountain and watch it hang and fly. And I remember now that I think about it, you know, when I was in Ireland, we may have talked about this, but the caddy, when we were playing Ballybunion is a you know, very frightening golf course for most everybody if the wind is up, because, you know, it just the ball blows everywhere, and it can just blow and get completely lost in the hip tall grass, and then what do you do? I mean, as an American, if you're keeping score, you're just devastated, you know. And so you start to really fear the ball going wayward. And I remember by the time we got to the 11th hole, which at Valley Bunyan, the tee is right on the cliff, you know, looking 100 feet down to the big white sand beaches that curve around, you know, in the distance. And Bill, the caddy, went to one of the guys in the group who was really struggling, and he teed up a ball that he found that, you know, he was collecting in his jacket pocket, and he invited Walt to hit his ball off the cliff out in the ocean. And Walt made a swing, and he didn't hit it particularly well, but it was a 100-foot cliff, and so we all just stood and watched the ball sail, and Bill teed another one up, and with that, Walt's swing was completely loosened up, and he just reared back, and he, all the flexibility and ease in the world, just smacked one out there. And Bill said, he said, "Well, Walt, now you can tell all your friends back home that you hit a good shot at Valley Bunyan." But then he said, "Walt, you must always swing as if you're hitting the ball into the ocean. Yeah. It's your best chance." And so, you know, so there's that.
Yeah.
You know, there's that pure joy of doing mm-hmm. it and not worrying so much about whether you made an
the
eight
results.
On that hole
sure.
or whether you're going to mm-hmm. record a 96 or a 78.
Mm-hmm. And that feeling, that pure joy is something that can be shared by golfers, but it's also so personal to each one of us, right? Like your pure joy goodness shot would be different than Ty's, which would be different than mine, which would be different than, you know, Tiger Woods. I mean, if you watch Tiger Woods play golf, it's pretty obvious he's not, like, thinking about how he has this basic goodness. He wants to, like, murder his competition, it seems like. But so it's not like the best players get to experience this more. I think it's maybe even the other way of the very beginners that really get to enjoy it almost more. You know, that first time you actually hit a ball into the air. The first time I taught my wife how to play golf, she was really mad at me because I made her go to the driving range first, and she wanted to go to the golf course. She thought it was so, she was like, actually was mad. And we got to the driving range, and she couldn't hit the ball for like 20 swings. She was missing the ball, and she was so frustrated. And then she got to make contact, but it wasn't going in the air. And then finally, literally like the last ball of the day, this is in Buffalo, Minnesota, in the middle of nowhere, in a driving range that like you literally put cash under a rock and grab golf balls out of a bucket. The last one we had, he had closed down, so there's no other way to hit a ball. She hits a ball that launches high and goes so far into the air, and she's like, oh I get it now. And so, but it's like, it's moments like those that, you know, like that wouldn't have been a good shot for me. It went as far as like my pitching wedge would have gone. But for her, you know, that was the one thing that gave her this feeling.
Well, that's a great perspective. Because, you know, I think that one of the things that I grew up believing, and I heard it again down at the the PGA show in Orlando when I was at the teaching and coaching summit. One of the presenters made the statement. He was talking about golf, and then he was talking about tour players, and he called that real golf, which I thought was that is a thing in golf culture that really rubs me the wrong way, that somehow, you know, the best golf in the world is what we call real golf. I think that's absolutely nonsense. Golf is a game about personal dreams and personal enjoyment, and it's accessible to anybody. That's real golf. Real golf is you know, full involvement and interest and pleasure, you know, from whatever it is, that from the ball soaring in the air to the feeling of solidness off the club to the feeling of perfect connection through your body as you deliver, you know, the weight of a well-sequenced swing into mm-hmm. the back of a ball. I mean, that's a, you know, there's all kinds of, like you were saying, all kinds of enjoyments that we can get. And that's real golf.
That's ridiculous. The idea that golf gets more real, like, the better your score gets. I wonder even how many golfers would agree with that.
Well, you know, it was a culture that I grew up in. Everybody, you know, talked that way. You know, when you know, when you were in the men's locker rooms and you were talking about a guy who was really a stick, you know, really somebody who could play, and that's what literally mm-hmm. the way it said, oh man, that guy can really play. He's a player. You know, not you, not like you,
yeah,
or you.
So would you say that perspective has kind of shifted a little bit in golf? There's all these books that, like Zen Golf or Inner Game, which we've talked about. They're not new books, but are kind of like, seems like they're pushing back against that. Like the score is the only thing that matters, and there's other things too.
Yes, I think. Well, I think you how you put it is the right. It represents some pushback. But I wouldn't say that it represents yet what we would say is commonly held. Okay. I think most people, you know, this piece that's written here, you know, in the Zen Golf book, it really is speaking to, you know, what he refers to as a poverty mentality, and that is a way of being that comes about when that kind of thinking, like if you're not first, you're last. Mm-hmm. The Ricky Bobby Talladega Nights lesson that we all learn, in my case, at least a dozen times. I love watching that. But that's really is the way most of us think, and that's the way I thought. You know, I mean, if I wasn't Tom Watson, you know, hey, I shot a great round today. Oh, really? What'd you shoot? 74. You know, how good is that? That's two over par. You know, I mean, a good round is under par, right? That's what Tom Watson would shoot, mm-hmm. and so, you know, so. You know, if you're how good would you say a player like Luke Donald is anymore? You know, I mean, he's not on TV very much, and you would say, he's not a real player anymore. He's a has been. Well, I mean, be interesting to ask Luke Donald what kind of enjoyment he gets from, you know, his golf experiences, and if he has transcendent moments, and just because you know he's not. You know, in the top 10 in the world, does that mean that he's ashamed of his golf game, doesn't want to do it anymore? You know,
who knows?
I think that's the way our society tends to talk about this stuff. I think it's, you know, you can read it in anything. It can be in the political. Commentary or in the sports commentary, yeah. You know, it's like Mitch Trubisky. I mean, is he ascending or is he inconsistent? You know, I mean, what is he? What story do you have about him? Well, what story really matters? I mean, I think the brilliant thing about, you know, the Bears is that in the way they handle that is that they do what most successful teams do, and that's insulate themselves from all that outside chatter, everybody else's stories, and you tell your own story. But I think a lot of people that I've seen on the lesson tee over the years, you know, do the paragraphs that in this Zen Golf book, and we'll read some more, sometimes sound like they're saying you don't need to change a thing to in yourself to be able to play good golf. But I don't think that's what they're saying. I think that they're basically saying we can strive, and we're all striving to become, to grow, to become more capable and complex beings. But we shouldn't suffer, you know, from our endeavors. That the suffering part of it, that the notion that we're not good enough, that we need to, you know, continually strive and improve to prove ourselves, you know, that is an intriguing ego game. And, you know, it's a game that a part of me plays every time I play golf.
Yeah, trying to prove something to yourself or others.
Sure.
By your numbers. And I see that a lot with my college golfers, too, that even in a practice round, like the number they would rather play around and they hate doing like practice rounds where you hit all extra balls, because then at the end you won't have like a real score to tell people about. And so I think that's, you know, kind of what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. It is absolutely what I'm talking about. Yeah, it's not really a growth mentality. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the hardest things to teach competitive golfers, you know, especially high school golfers, you know, to really make use of a practice round, because the way a high school golfer generally will use the practice round is just the way your college golfers did, mm-hmm. not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And so then they'll start to tell themselves stories, you know, about it's not a hard course. I scored really well on it. And then they won't be really seeing the golf course, you know. And so then tomorrow they go out and they hit it into different places, and they didn't learn anything the day before because they didn't have their eyes open. Mm-hmm. That wasn't why they went out. They went out to, you know, just golf their ball along as best they could, and there was a sort of a myopia, you know, where their vision wasn't expansive and taking everything in, but was really focused. And, you know, with me, it was always focused down at my shoes, walking along deep in my own thoughts about, you know, seeing if I could get around into the clubhouse that I could have as a trophy.
Yeah. Do you want to read those next chunk there?
It is a perspective of richness, wholeness, that nothing in our fundamental being is flawed or missing. Acknowledging our own basic goodness means taking the attitude that there is something fundamentally, essentially right with us. How we feel about ourselves as a person need not depend on the quality of a particular shot or the outcome of a round. That perspective is very different from the attitude most prevalent in the world today. There is a need to prove our worth again and again that stems from the underlying view that there is something fundamentally wrong with us. We think that in order to be who we want to be, we need to be something different than what we are. This is a poverty mentality, the feeling that we're not good enough, that we're broken and need to be fixed, that we're missing something that needs to be added to make us whole. Like the gold statue, over the years, our basic goodness has become covered over with self-doubt and fear. Memory of your natural contentment has faded, and we think that the way our feelings of inadequacy is to gold plate ourselves into looking better. That's the stuff of
new Titleist hats make me feel better.
Yeah. Is that
and
what
you
need?
Look better too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is that all you need to get out of your poverty mentality?
Yeah, exactly.
Is a new hat.
Hey man, if I can't shoot below par, at least I can look good. I don't know.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, I think that was the thing. You know, again, I think when I got into the golf business, the idea was to develop a good swing. You know, and that was the real trophy. You couldn't have a funky swing. You needed to have a swing that was conforming to the look, because that swing we were quite confident would produce consistently good golf shots. And it's hard to argue that that's not the case, but we do know that the idea that if you have a technically solid golf swing, that means that you'll be able to stand up to pressure moments is a complete mm-hmm. ridiculous notion. They're two separate different things. But at least you could look good, you know, if you developed a good looking golf swing.
Mm-hmm.
And someone would say about you, like Roy Hobbs always wanted, you know, in the natural, there goes Roy Hobbs, the
greatest
ball player that ever lived. Uh-huh. You know, and hey, there goes Ty Libby. He's got a great golf swing.
Oof. Does he ever? But yeah, as far as like, you know, this sentence, the underlying view that there's something fundamentally wrong with us, I think that's how I began my golf journey. As if I hit a terrible shot or had a terrible round, it's not even that you think, you know, if you step back and think about it for a second, okay, this doesn't reflect upon me as a person, then you can challenge that thought. But just the fact that it immediately comes into your head is crazy in and of itself. And so it's important to really, for me at least, let that go. And you know, my golf shots are not who I am. My golf rounds are not who I am. And, you know, have more of an idea of personal par and focus on the good shots that I do hit. So, yeah, I try not to get away from that idea of, oh, God, I played terrible. I'm a fundamentally terrible person. Whereas, you know, I think it's natural for a lot of people, especially, like you said, in our Western society, to think that way.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be motivated to buy, you know, what they're trying to market to us.
Good point.
Wow. So where are we all brainwashed by Callaway and Titleist?
Well, you know, I think what you're seeing is yes, we certainly are. I mean, because, you know, that's what's creating the culture, right? I mean, you know, they're telling the stories that they want to tell, and you know, we know that if you hear something often enough, you know, if it gets dragged in front of you often enough, it becomes familiar to you, and then it starts to feel like the truth. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I think the luxury vacations, you know, that they peddle, and you know, all of the stuff that's in there, it's not that it's bad. These are beautiful places to go to. Mm-hmm. You know, and but the idea that what is good golf and what isn't good golf, you know, is like,
or what is real golf and what is what is, you know, not really golf.
Yeah. And that you would need a certain trip or a certain club or certain clothes to be playing real golf or else you need to
have a, you know, a perfect grip or a great setup or a wonderful takeaway to be a real golfer, you know, and you know, that's kind of, it's a quandary that we get into and, you know, in teaching at every level. But I mean, if you're teaching the kids and you say, you know, I think what you notice in parents and grandparents, especially who are lovers of golf, is that they, the results that they want to see, even with the youngest kids, is technical correctness. And what you're hearing educators, you know, in youth sports say is, what you really want is to ignite their enthusiasm, their enjoyment of what they're doing, and they'll become lifetime participants, and there'll be plenty of time for them to, you know, grip it good and stand, you know, perfectly to the ball and stuff like that. But
who wants to be told what to do, especially when you're 7 years old? So golf can just become someone telling you you're doing something wrong the whole time. So maybe that explains why we all get into a poverty mentality, because it's beaten to our heads since we started playing.
Yes, I think that's right. I think you're right. I think we were taught by people who had that mentality, you know, and I mean, it gets passed on, I think, from generation to generation. I mean, well, you know, I think it's a difficult thing. Of course, you know, I remember my father, you know, pitching balls to me in the backyard, and I had a heck of a time, you know, hitting a moving baseball. I remember, and then he enlisted my mother as the substitute, so that when he was, you know, working and on the road, she could give me the practice in the backyard. And you know, there's, you know, all kinds of advice, you know, the swing over the ball,
keep your head down,
yeah, all that kind of stuff. But I didn't learn to hit until, you know, I was out in the sand lots with my friends, and, you know, and we had enough reps and enough time and enough fun, you know, because we were switching up our activities between, you know, hot box and 500 and
pickle, you know,
and
that.
Pickle and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was varied and it was fun, and it wasn't always a test. You know, I mean, it was okay for you to strike out because, you know,
yeah.
And I was kind of the opposite, Pete, whereas I was playing baseball from five and had a lot of trouble hitting the stationary golf ball. And so, you know, of course, I think your parents want to help you and want to want you to do well. And so, you know, stand like this, spread your feet, you know, keep your arms straight, keep your head down, watch the ball hit the club, all this stuff. And, you know, it can really get in the way. And if you're not doing it well, and especially not doing it well quickly, then it becomes, you know, I'm frustrated by this. You're telling me something wrong. Why are you telling me something wrong? I don't want to do this anymore. Very quickly.
Yeah, you yeah. just said it.
And that I think it's that first step of like igniting interest that's the hardest for us to do, or for people teaching something to do. And we've talked about it with our classes and stuff. And it's like if a kid doesn't want to hit a downhill shot over a bunker onto the green, if like that's not interesting or fascinating to them, they're not going to like they'll hit the ball, but it's not like they're going to actually care enough to learn how to do it. And right. so you need that first spark, like you and your friends at the Sandlot, of like, we're just doing this for fun, and it's fun because it's there and we're together and we're doing something. And you can't like manufacture it, or you can't force it. It's just
watch this shot I'm about to hit. It's like, yeah. Oh, that was a great shot. I want to do something like that. Hey, can you do it?
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I was just I was thinking about that earlier, you know, about the most fun that you could have, you know, playing golf, because there are a lot of good ideas now, especially, you know, for kids, in terms of, you know, let's don't have them play the traditional ladies' tees. Let's actually build tees that are close enough to the green that they can have an experience of shooting 72 or 68, mm-hmm. You know, and now that creates a challenge of, like, there's a long walk between the green and the next tee. Yeah. If your tee, you know, if it's for an adult, a 400-yard hole, and your tee is up at the 150-yard marker. But, you know, I was thinking about how we could make that walk, you know, just as much fun as the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And what I saw, you know, as I think we talked about it before, but just give the child a wood club or a hybrid club and give them an almost golf ball and just let them run and chase it and swing and chase it and let them, you know, chase their way down to the next tee. And, you know, I mean, it makes me laugh like crazy when I see mm-hmm. kids running like that and having mm-hmm. fun. And I think, you know, that laughter and that kind of exhilaration, I think, wow, who wouldn't love this? As opposed to, you know, make sure you stand like this. No.
There's the decorum here, young man. Follow the club rules. No running.
That's exactly right. Well, Well, and maybe it isn't for Bushwood, but it definitely is for Canal Shores.
Right.
Yeah. Well, should we
venture
move on? Yeah.
Our swing is the gold statue of our golf game. When we make a poor shot, we usually assume that something is wrong with our swing. Therefore, we think we need to do something to fix it, to add something to make it whole, to change something about it to make it right. And that's like adding gold plate on top of clay. Quick fixes and patch-up jobs during the round will only take you further and further from understanding what you're doing when you swing. Just adding more gold on top of the clay takes us further from the real gold underneath. However, by not fixing your swing, you will start to recognize patterns and be more realistic in your targets and yardages. Seeing the patterns in your shots without trying to change them will allow you to be more aware of what you're doing to produce them. That gives you the information and insight you need to go to the practice tee or the lesson tee and work on changing your habits. We don't need to gold plate our swing. We just need to dissolve the clay of interference that obscures the pure golf of what our body already knows how to do. I think that's a typo. That obscures the pure gold of what our body already knows how to do. Taking this different perspective means transforming our poverty mentality into a richness mentality. Recognizing basic goodness of our own nature becomes the impetus for discovering unconditional confidence. The wayward shots no longer become punishment or confirmation of our failings, but clues to help us discover how to remove more and more clay so that our game can eventually shine like solid gold.
All right. So this is maybe the most important part of this chapter and also the one that could perhaps lead us astray the most, because on first reading it kind of seems like the key to good golf is to not try to fix your swing. So what do you think about that? I know what you think, but I'm giving you a chance to...
I think it's hogwash.
Okay.
It sounds like... it's only what it sounds like
right.
At first. It's not what it's... But I believe that it's actually saying. I think that the idea of collecting data... You know, taking a long-term view of saying, listen, if I start out with a swing notion and the swing notion seems to fail on that shot, mm-hmm. or my attempt produced a big slice. So instead of immediately assuming that your swing has this basic flaw in it that's going to be repeated, that you don't think that you think, no, my swing's okay. It's I'm going to do my best on my next one. And now if you do that again and you produce another slice, and well, now you've got, two data points. But if you're constantly, working on little, if I hit a slice, that means now I've got to adjust my grip or take a closed stance, swing more inside out, roll my forearms over. And that's the way you're going to act, that every single error you're going to make, you're going to go through some major correction in your mind, that's mm-hmm. madness.
Yeah. And that's why you need I think that speaks to why you need lessons or need someone to help you work through it all, because it's really hard to do by yourself.
Yes.
We had some of our North Park guys were here, and Jansen and I were helping them out, and... one guy on our team, Jake, he was hitting this 6-iron that started out perfectly straight and then was hooking about 15 yards to the right. And all we had on the track man was just like total and carry. And so he was trying to swing further out. He's a lefty, so he's trying to swing further out to the left to get the draw to start, on the left side and come back to the middle. But then when we pulled up his path numbers, his path was 5 degrees left, and the club face was like 9 degrees closed. So that's was producing the straight starting shot that hooked to the right. But it's hard to, you don't know that off first glance. And so that's was kind of like an example of, oh, you're on the course, you hit a ball, it starts straight and hooks to the right. Oh, I'm just going to try to swing further left, and that's actually going to make the problem even worse.
Right.
And so I think that's really like the danger of trying to do this like quick fix work. Is you end up, by the end of the round, you're more lost than when you started.
Yes, and I think that has to do with, the basic education, that we provide, for students or someone that wants to take up the game. Because, as you're saying right there, that was an issue. I remember way back when they started the skins games, when Arnold Palmer and was playing Jack Nicklaus and Lee Trevino and Gary Player and Tom Watson and guys like that. That Arnold had the same problem, and his solution to the hooking action that was going left was to do just exactly that. He was swinging it more to the right, and just it started hooking faster and faster because you've got a larger and larger discrepancy, you're creating more spin.
Variation, yeah.
Yeah, and how to actually learn to use a golf club or learn how it works so that you can create just like a kid with a ping pong paddle, can create a topspin or can create an underspin, by different combinations of club face, racket face open or closed and path going more up or more down. Golf is the same thing. That golfers somehow, when they come in, we need fairly early on to give them this notion of how to create spin through path and club face so that it's a more they become fluent, you know, in the language of the swing. Why does the ball go where it goes? You know, this is our job is to make all of that what do we mean by hit down on the ball? You know, more vivid, more experiential, more like, oh, I learned it. It wasn't just that my teacher told me. It wasn't secondhand knowledge. It was real. It was firsthand knowledge because I did it. And I think that if you. That's not what's being peddled today. Mm. Not peddled. What I mean by that is, I think teachers, like if you look at the Golf Channel, I think guys like Michael Breed and that great Aussie guy who's
Martin
on
Hall.
There now,
Cameron McCormick.
I mean, all those guys, you know, are trying to be as clear as they can be. But the magazines. You know, they're peddling fixes. They're not peddling knowledge.
Yeah, it's do this to
hit
it.
That.
Yeah, right.
So that you'll never, hit it like, you know, Dustin Johnson or, you know, hit it like, who's the hot thing now?
Matthew Wolf.
Oh, no. Cameron Champ is the one they talk about over and over, which is ridiculous. He has one win in a tournament that no one was in. And he's already been on the cover of Golf Digest.
Well, I mean,
he hasn't done anything.
It's marketing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly.
That great looking girl out in San Diego. I mean,
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I don't know. I just heard something about her. I haven't ever seen her, but.
Well, maybe we'll cover her on the next podcast.
Okay.
But yeah, I know you're right. It is marketing. They're saying be like this to.
So I understand, you know, this idea about you don't want a quick fix or a patch job on the course. I mean, I think for the most part that makes sense to me. And maybe this is different at an amateur level versus a pro level. But how does that compare to other sports like football? And it's like, all right, he's got to go in. He's got to make some halftime adjustments here. And maybe that's not necessarily a quick fix, but. You know, you see pro golfers do it. You see amateur golfers do it in competitive play where, you know, you hit a bad shot or they're trying to hit a draw and it goes straight. And so they stand there and practice their swing three or four times after the shot to try to get a quote unquote the feeling back. So, yeah, I understand maybe I, Ty Libby, shouldn't be trying to do quick fixes on the golf course during my round, but. Who should be? I mean, should you ever be trying to come up with a fix to a mistake that you cognitively knew you made? Okay, I understand club path. I understand club face and the relation. And I was trying to hit a draw, and I understand why the ball did not draw. Should I be trying to address that in my brain or should I say, oh, next time it'll probably work out?
You know, and that's why I said when Andy asked me what I thought, you know, it sounds like hogwash to me, you know. No need to change, you know. But if I don't like the shots I'm hitting, you're just asking me to be happy, you know, with what I'm producing, and that goes against my nature, to which is to seek to strive towards mastery. Mm. You know, unless there's some really compelling reason for me to do nothing, I'm going to do something. To change, unless I feel like no, this is really important because I've got to, you know, just accept. I got to learn today's lesson. I've decided is acceptance. Mm-hmm. So there will be no endeavoring. There will simply be lining it up and swinging and emptying my mind. But I agree with you. I mean, if I'm out on the course and I've made an error. You know, I would like to, if I can, I'd like to organize that correction right there and get complete with that swing before I leave the tee, so that I won't be obsessing over it or worrying over it walking down the fairway. I will have said, I got that. You know, at let's say at the moment of, you know, I was out of balance. You know, at the moment, or I tried to throw it to, you know, the weight too hard, and I, you know, I lost my balance or my posture as a result of it, and the club face, you know, opened or closed, and the ball flew off. And so I think they're talking about here is the mindset that every time you make a mistake, you're going to go into a fixed mode, mm-hmm. instead of just saying, you know, maybe I swung too hard, or you know, or just kind of relax.
It's just a bad swing, maybe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. not torture yourself over. Not say, you know, as they say, what's wrong with me?
Yeah,
you know.
Jack Nicklaus had a quote or talks about like playing the swing that you brought to the course. Are you familiar with that, or at least that idea of? And I think what he means is like through his warm up and through, yeah, I would say through his warm up, he learned what type of swing he has that day. Some days it's going to be different than others. Some days he's be able to work it both ways with ease. Some days it's going to be harder than that. And so I think that instruction of using the swing you brought to the course is similar to what, you know, he's talking about here in this book of like, don't, of just be aware of what you can do and hit the shot that you know you can hit, not the shot you necessarily like ought to be able to hit or you feel like you should be able to hit, but the one you know you can do. And so if maybe on the first tee, you're set up for a draw and you hit a huge slice over the hole, like maybe a fade is your shot for that day and you just can trust that and play that shot over and over again rather than trying to fix and get back to perfect. I think that's what they're getting at.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, you know, that would make very good sense.
Or you even like you have your first, and again, maybe this is different for each golfer, but you're hitting a greenside shot and you try to hit a high flop shot and you end up sculling it over the green. So next time you're faced that situation, you're really nervous and scared. And so maybe you either try it again and fail, or you play something you know you can hit and are more comfortable with rather than like, again, that.
The situation Ricky was in at the Waste Management this past week where he skidded the ball over the green and could have taken the same shot, which was relatively easier, but, you know, took a harder drop next to the water and made it work out, ended up winning the tournament. But, you know, maybe you're scared to hit that shot a second time.
Well, yeah, it was unusual to, yes, I think that a lot of people, myself included, that saw him walk across that green and then have to drop it on a hill that his ball wouldn't even stay on. That can't be really an easy shot. Maybe it is. Maybe he thought, yeah, throwing this thing up in the air off an uphill lie, it'll just stop it dead, and that's easier than. But you're right, and I think, Andy, I appreciate, you know, what you're saying, because I do think that the author is saying that here, that if you open your mind to other possibilities other than, oh, I ought to be able to hit this shot, you know, and instead let's assess who you are today and recognize that, like, yes, if you've just, as happened to me down in Florida on the recent trip, trying to play off of that tight Bermuda grass around the greens was just embarrassing. I felt like somebody had pulled my pants down and was spanking me. but you know, the way that I was going about doing it, I had to change it because it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't working. And so I had to come up with something that was more of a no-choke stroke just to, and I had to forget about, you know, trying to get the ball really close to the hole because, you know, I was hitting it over either short or over the greens. And so, you know, mm-hmm. just trying to come up with something that put it on the green was better off. Now, when you've got a chance, you know, after the round to work on that.
That's where you work on
that's
it.
That's where
though.
You do it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it circles back to what you're saying earlier about how people just want to have, like, the perfect-looking swing or be able to hit a nice, tight draw or whatever. And if we have that going into it, that almost like poverty mentality of if I don't have a perfect swing, if I can't hit these shots, then I'm somehow not good enough. That like that, I guess, is what this chapter is all about avoid, about like, no, you're actually like good underneath, that you don't need to have this perfect swing or this perfect shot. It's just you're going to play and however you and do it the best you can, really.
Yeah.
I think that's what I would say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that to me was I think was a turning point in my golfing life was when I realized how I said it to myself is, well, what can I make out of myself today? Because, you know, some days I'd really feel like I had everything, and then other days I'd feel like I didn't. And you know, when I'm, and what I mean by that is, you know, I either couldn't, you know, hit my low irons very well, or you know, or my driver was going 15 degrees to the right of where I was aiming, or I seemed to be kind of edgy and unconfident. You know, I would make different decisions. I would play differently to try to maximize, you know, what I had, instead of, you know, going for the shots that I really felt like maybe were in that unadvisable zone. You know, like
seeing the patterns of your shots without trying to change them will allow you to be more aware of what you're doing to produce them.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Jack, going, circling back to Jack Nicklaus, you know, showing up and you're seeing the patterns in your shot that day. You know, don't try to change them. Just be more aware of what's happening and let it ride.
Yeah, that's really golfing your ball.
Yeah.
You know, it's a larger vision, than just lining it up and going for, you know, the dream shot, you know, on every single swing. I think the grades of how you play, you know, I think the idea of, as we've talked in the past, of going back over the round and choosing your best plays of the day, not your best shots, but your best plays, which includes what you did in the think box and then what you did in the play box.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's golf. You know, it's
that's real golf.
That's
redefine it. Let's take it back.
Take it back is right. That is real golf. You're right. You know, that's really playing the game.
Yeah.
Know, and that's with your emotions, your thoughts, you know, and your physical tools too. You know, that's beautifully done.
Well said. Well, I think that's a good spot to wrap up.
Yep.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, Ty.
Thanks, Andy.
Talk to you all next time.